Think about this story for a moment. The first lesson is that Friedman was willing to work hard, take responsibility for himself, and put himself through school. But the second, perhaps more important lesson, is that he happened to come along at a time in America where, if he were willing to work hard, you could take responsibility for yourself and put yourself through school. Friedman was, at the time, what we would today call economically disadvantaged. He was an inner-city kid from the Bronx, neither of whose parents went to college. But look at how easy it was for him to get a good education. He graduated from his public high school in New York at a time when they were the envy of the world. And his first option, City College, was free. And his second option, Michigan, was just $450. And the admissions process was casual enough, apparently, that you could try one school one day and the other the next. And how did you get there? You hitchhiked, with the money that you made in the summer in your pocket, and when you arrived, you immediately got a series of really good jobs to help pay your way, because the factories were looking for people. And of course they were. They had to feed the needs of the big generation just ahead of those born in the demographic trough of the 1930s, and the big generation of baby boomers coming up behind them. The sense of possibility so necessary for success comes not just from inside of us, or from our parents. It comes from our time, from the particular opportunities that our particular place in history present us with. For a young would-be lawyer, being born in the early 1930s was a magic time, just as being born in 1955 was for a software programmer, or being born in 1835 was for an entrepreneur. Today, Mort Janklow has an office high above Park Avenue, filled with gorgeous works of modern art, a Du Buffet, an Anselm Kiefer. He tells hilarious stories. My mother had two sisters. One lived to be 99, the other died at 90. The 99-year-old was a smart woman. She married my Uncle Al, who was the chief of sales for Maidenform. Once I said to him, "What's the rest of the country like, Uncle Al?" And he said, "Kiddo, when you leave New York, every place is Bridgeport." Janklow gives the sense that the world is his for the taking. "I've always been a big risk-taker," he says. "When I built the cable company in the early stages, I was making deals where I would have been bankrupt if I hadn't pulled it off. I had confidence that I could make it work." Mort Janklow went to New York City public schools when they were at their best. Maurice Janklow went to New York City public schools when they were at their most crowded. Mort Janklow went to Columbia University Law School because demographic trough babies have their pick of selective schools. Maurice Janklow went to Brooklyn Law School, which was as good as an immigrant child could do in 1919. Mort Janklow sold his cable business for tens of millions of dollars. Maurice Janklow closed titles for $25. The story of the Janklows tells us that the meteoric rise of Joe Flom could not have happened any time. Even the most gifted of lawyers, equipped with the best of family lessons, cannot escape the limitations of their generation. "My mother was coherent until the last 5 or 6 months of her life," Mort Janklow said. "And in her delirium, she talked about things she'd never talked about before. She shed tears over her friends dying in the 1918 flu epidemic. That generation, my parents' generation, lived through a lot. They lived through that epidemic, which took, what, 10% of the world's population? Panic in the streets, friends dying, and then the First World War, then the Depression, then the Second World War. They didn't have much of a chance. That was a very tough period. My father would have been much more successful in a different kind of world." Lesson number 3, the garment industry and meaningful work. In 1889, Louis and Regina Borgenecht boarded an ocean liner in Hamburg, bound for America. Louis was from Galicia, in what was then Poland. Regina was from a small town in Hungary. They had been married only a few years, and had one small child and a second on the way. For the 13-day journey, they slept on straw mattresses on a deck above the engine room, hanging tight to their bunk beds as the ship pitched and rolled. They knew one person in New York, Borgenecht's sister Sally, who had immigrated 10 years before. They had enough money to last a few weeks at best. Like so many other immigrants to America in those years, theirs was a leap of faith. Louis and Regina found a tiny apartment on Eldridge Street in Manhattan's Lower East Side for $8 a month. Louis then took to the streets looking for work. He saw peddlers and fruit sellers and sidewalks crammed with pushcarts. He saw noise and activity and energy that dwarfed what he had come from in the old world. He was first overwhelmed, then invigorated. He went to his sister's fish store in Ludlow Street and convinced her to give him a consignment of herring on credit. He set up shop on the sidewalk with two barrels of fish, hopping back and forth between them, chanting in German, "For frying, for baking, for cooking, good also for eating. Herring will do for every meal and for every class." By the end of the week, he had cleared $8. By the second week, $13. Those were considerable sums, but Lewis and Regina could not see how selling herring on the street would lead to a constructive business. Lewis then decided to try being a pushcart peddler. He sold towels and tablecloths without much luck. He switched to notebooks, then bananas, then socks and stockings. Was there really a future in pushcarts? Regina gave birth to a second child, a daughter, and Lewis's urgency grew. He now had 4 mouths to feed. The answer came to him after 5 long days of walking up and down the streets of the Lower East Side, just as he was about to give up hope. He was sitting on an overturned box, eating a late lunch of the sandwiches Regina had made for him. It was close. Everywhere around him, stores were opening. Suits, dresses, overalls, shirts, skirts, blouses, trousers, all ready to be bought and worn. Coming from a world where clothing was made by hand or made to order by tailors, this was a revelation. To me, the greatest wonder in this was not the mere quantity of garments, although that was a miracle in itself, Bergnick would write years later, after he became a prosperous manufacturer of women and children's clothing, but the fact that in America, even poor people could save all the dreary, time-consuming labor of making their own clothes simply by going into a store and walking out with what they needed. There was a field to go into, a field to thrill to. Bergnick took out a small notebook. Everywhere he went, he wrote down what people were wearing and what was for sale, menswear, womenswear, children'swear. He wanted to find a novel item, something that people would wear that was not being sold in the stores. For 4 more days, he walked the streets. On the evening of the final day, as he walked towards home, he saw a 6 girls playing hopscotch. One of the girls caught his eye. She was wearing a tiny embroidered apron over her dress, cut low in the front with a tie in the back, and it struck him, suddenly, that in his previous days of relentlessly inventorying the clothing shops of the Lower East Side, he had never seen one of those aprons for sale. He came home and told Regina. She had an ancient sewing machine that they had bought upon their arrival in America. The next morning, he went to a dry goods store on Hester Street and bought 100 yards of gingham and 50 yards of white crossbar. He came back to their tiny apartment and laid the goods out on the dining room table. Regina began to cut the gingham, small sizes for toddlers, larger for small children, until she had 40 aprons. She began to sew. At midnight, she went to bed, and Lewis took up where she had left off. At dawn, she rose and began cutting buttonholes and adding buttons. By 10 in the morning, the aprons were finished. Lewis gathered them up over his arm and ventured out onto Hester Street. "Children's aprons, little girls' aprons, colored ones 10 cents, white ones 15 cents, little girls' aprons." By 1 o'clock, all 40 were gone. "Ma, we've got our business," he shouted out to Regina after running all the way home from Hester Street. "We made $2.60 in 3 hours of selling." He grabbed her by the waist and began swinging her around and around. "You've got to help me," he cried out. "We'll work together. Ma, this is our business." Jewish immigrants like the Floms and the Borgonecks and the Janklows were not like the other immigrants who came to America in the 19th and early 20th centuries. The Irish and the Italians were peasants, tenant farmers from the impoverished countryside of Europe. Not so the Jews. For centuries in Europe, they had been forbidden from owning land, and so they had clustered in cities and towns, taking up urban trades and professions. 70% of the Eastern European Jews who came through Ellis Island in the 30 years or so before the First World War had some kind of occupational skill. They had owned small groceries or jewelry stores. They had been bookbinders or watchmakers. Overwhelmingly, though, their experience lay in the clothing trade. They were tailors and dressmakers, hat and cap makers, and furriers and tanners. Louis Borgnicht, for example, left the impoverished home of his parents at age 12 to work as a sales clerk in a general store in the Polish town of Brzeszko. When the opportunity came to work in Schnitwaren Handlung, literally the handling of cloth and fabrics, or piece goods as they were known, he jumped at it. In those days, the piece goods man was clothier to the world, he writes. And of the three fundamentals required for life in that simple society, food and shelter were humble. Clothing was the aristocrat. Practitioners of the clothing art, dealers in wonderful cloths from every corner of Europe, traders who visited the centers of industry on their annual buying tours, these were the merchant princes of my youth. Their voices were heard, their weight felt. Borgnicht worked in piece goods for a man named Epstein, then moved on to a store in neighboring Jaschwaf called Brandstatter's. It was there that the young Borgnicht learned the ins and outs of all the dozens of different varieties of cloth, to the point where he could run his hand over a fabric and tell you the thread count, the name of the manufacturer, and the place of its origin. A few years later, Borgnicht moved to Hungary and met Regina. She had been running a dressmaking business since the age of 16. Together, they opened a series of small piece goods stores, painstakingly learning the ins and outs of small business entrepreneurship. Borgnicht's great brainstorm that day on the upturned box on Hester Street, then, did not come from nowhere. He was a veteran of Schnitwaren Handlung, and his wife was a seasoned dressmaker. This was their field. And at the same time as the Borgnichts set up shop inside their tiny apartment, thousands of other Jewish immigrants were doing the same thing, putting their sewing and dressmaking and tailoring skills to use, to the point where, by 1900, control of the garment industry had passed almost entirely into the hands of the Eastern European newcomers. As Borgnicht puts it, the Jews bit deep into the welcoming land and worked like madmen at what they knew. Today, at a time when New York is the center of an enormous and diversified metropolitan area, it is easy to forget the significance of the set of skills that immigrants like the Borgnichts brought to the New World. From the late 19th century through the middle of the 20th century, the garment trade was the largest and most economically vibrant industry in the city. More people worked making clothes in New York than worked at anything else, and more clothes were manufactured in New York than in any other city in the world. To this day, the distinctive buildings that you see when you walk down the lower half of Broadway in Manhattan, from the big 10 and 15-story industrial warehouses that run for 20 blocks below Times Square to the cast-iron lofts of Soho and Tribeca, were almost all built to house coat makers and hat makers and lingerie manufacturers and huge rooms of men and women hunched over sewing machines. To come to New York City in the 1890s with a background in dressmaking or sewing or Schnitwaren Handlung was a stroke of extraordinary good fortune. It was like showing up in Silicon Valley in 1986 with 10,000 hours of computer programming already under your belt. There is no doubt that those Jewish immigrants arrived at the perfect time with the perfect skills, says the sociologist Steven Steinberg. To exploit that opportunity, you had to have certain virtues, and those immigrants worked hard. They sacrificed, they scrimped and saved and invested wisely, but still, you have to remember that the garment industry in those years was growing by leaps and bounds. The economy was desperate for the skills that they possessed. Louis and Regina Borgnicht and the thousands of others who came over on the boats with them were given a golden opportunity, and so were their children and grandchildren. Because the lessons those garment workers brought home with them in the evenings turned out to be critical for getting ahead in the world. The day after Louis and Regina Borgnicht sold out their first lot of 40 aprons, Louis made his way to H.B. Claflin & Company. Claflin was a dry goods commission house, the equivalent of Brandstatter's back in Poland. There, Borgnicht asked for a salesman who spoke German, since his English was almost non-existent. He had in his hand his and Regina's life savings, $125, and with that money, he bought enough cloth to make 10 dozen aprons. Day and night, he and Regina cut and sewed. He sold all 10 dozen in 2 days. Back he went to Claflin for another round. They sold those too. Before long, he and Regina hired another immigrant just off the boat to help with the children so Regina could sew full-time, and another to serve as an apprentice. Lewis ventured uptown as far as Harlem, selling to the mothers in the tenements. He rented a storefront on Sheriff Street with living quarters in the back. He hired three more girls and bought sewing machines for all of them. He became known as the Apron Man. He and Regina were selling aprons as fast as they could make them. Before long, the Bourgonics decided to branch out. They started making adult aprons, then petticoats, then women's dresses. By January of 1892, the Bourgonics had 20 people working for them, mostly immigrant Jews like themselves. They had their own factory in the Lower East Side of Manhattan and a growing list of customers, including a store uptown owned by another Jewish immigrant family, the Bloomingdale brothers. Keep in mind, the Bourgonics had only been in the country for 3 years at this point. They barely spoke English, and they weren't rich yet by any stretch of the imagination. Whatever profit they made got plowed back into their business, and Bourgonics says he only had $200 in the bank, but already he was in charge of his own destiny. This was the second great advantage of the garment industry. It wasn't just that it was growing by leaps and bounds. It was also explicitly entrepreneurial. Clothes weren't made in a single big factory. Instead, a number of established firms designed patterns and prepared the fabric, and then the complicated stitching and pressing and button attaching was all sent out to small contractors. And if a contractor got big enough, or ambitious enough, he started designing his own patterns and preparing his own fabric. By 1913, there were something like 16,000 separate companies in the city's garment business, many just like the Bourgonics shop on Sheriff Street. The threshold for getting involved in the business was very low. It was basically a business built on the sewing machine, and sewing machines don't cost that much, says Daniel Sawyer, a historian who has written widely on the garment industry. So you didn't need a lot of capital. And at the turn of the 20th century, it was probably $50 to buy a machine or two. All you had to do to be a contractor was to have a couple sewing machines, some irons, and a couple of workers. The profit margins were very low, but you could make some money. Listen to how Bourgonics describes his decision to expand beyond aprons. From my study of the market, I knew that only three men were making children's dresses in 1890. One was an East Side tailor, near me, who made only to order, while the other two turned out an expensive product with which I had no desire at all to compete. I wanted to make popular-priced stuff, wash dresses, silks and woolens. It was my goal to produce dresses that the great mass of the people could afford, dresses that would, from the business angle, sell equally well to both large and small city and country stores. With Regina's help, she always had excellent taste and judgment, I made up a line of samples. Displaying them to all my old customers and friends, I hammered home every point. My dresses would save mothers endless work. The materials and sewing were as good and probably better than anything that could be done at home. The price was right for quick disposal. On one occasion, Bourgonics realized that his only chance to undercut bigger firms was to convince the wholesalers to sell cloth to him directly, cutting out the middlemen. He went to see a Mr. Bingham at Lawrence and Company, a tall, gaunt, white-bearded Yankee with steel-blue eyes. There the two of them were, the immigrant from rural Poland, his eyes ringed with fatigue, facing off in his halting English against the imperious Yankee. Bourgonics said he wanted to buy 40 cases of cashmere. Bingham had never before sold to an individual company, let alone a shoestring operation on Sheriff Street. "You have a hell of a cheek coming in here and asking for favors," Bingham thundered. But he ended up saying yes. What Bourgonics was getting in his 18-hour days was a lesson in the modern economy. He was learning market research. He was learning manufacturing. He was learning how to negotiate with imperious Yankees. He was learning how to plug himself into popular culture in order to understand new fashion trends. The Irish and Italian immigrants who came to New York in the same period didn't have that same advantage. They didn't have a skill specific to the urban economy. They went to work as day laborers and domestics and construction workers, jobs where you could show up for work every day for 30 years and never learn market research and manufacturing and how to navigate the popular culture and how to negotiate with the Yankees who ran the world. Or consider the fate of the Mexicans who immigrated to California between 1900 and the end of the 1920s to work in the fields of the big fruit and vegetable growers. They simply exchanged the life of a feudal peasant in Mexico for the life of a feudal peasant in California. The conditions in the garment industry were every bit as bad, Sawyer goes on, but as a garment worker, you were closer to the center of the industry. If you are working in a field in California, you have no clue what's happening to the produce when it gets on the truck. If you're working in a small garment shop, your wages are low, and your conditions are terrible, and your hours are long, but you can see exactly what the successful people are doing, and you can see how you can set up your own job. When Borgonecht came home at night to his children, he may have been tired and poor and overwhelmed, but he was alive. He was his own boss. He was responsible for his own decisions and direction. His work was complex. It engaged his mind and imagination. And in his work, there was a relationship between effort and reward. The longer he and Regina stayed up at night sewing aprons, the more money they made the next day on the streets. Those three things, autonomy, complexity, and a connection between effort and reward, are the three qualities that work has to have if it is to be satisfying. It's not how much money we make that ultimately makes us happy between 9 and 5. It's whether our work fulfills us. If I offered you a choice between being an architect for $50,000 a year and working in a toll booth every day for the rest of your life for $100,000 a year, which would you take? I'm guessing the former, because there is complexity, autonomy, and a relationship between effort and reward in doing creative work, and that's worth more to most of us than money. Work that fulfills those three criteria is meaningful. Being a teacher is meaningful. Being a physician is meaningful. So is being an entrepreneur, and the miracle of the garment industry, as cutthroat and grim as it was that it allowed people like the Borgonecks, just off the boat, to find something meaningful to do as well. When Louis Borgonecht came home, after first seeing that child's apron, he danced a jig. He hadn't sold anything yet. He was still penniless and desperate, and he knew that to make something of his idea was going to require years of back-breaking labor. But he was ecstatic, because the prospect of those endless years of hard labor did not seem like a burden to him. Bill Gates had that same feeling when he first sat down at the keyboard at Lakeside. And the Beatles didn't recoil in horror when they were told they had to play 8 hours a night, 7 days a week. They jumped at the chance. Hard work is a prison sentence only if it does not have meaning. Once it does, it becomes the kind of thing that makes you grab your wife around the waist and dance a jig. The most important consequence of the miracle of the garment industry, though, was what happened to the children growing up in those homes where meaningful work was practiced. Can you imagine what it must have been like to watch the meteoric rise of Regina and Louis Borgonecht through the eyes of one of their children? You would learn the same lesson that little Alex Williams would learn nearly a century later, a lesson crucial to those who wanted to tackle the upper reaches of a profession like law or medicine. If you work hard enough and assert yourself and use your mind and imagination, you can shape the world to your desires. In 1982, a sociology graduate student named Louise Farkas went to visit a series of nursing homes and residential hotels in New York City and Miami Beach. She was looking for people like the Borgonecks, or more precisely, the children of people like the Borgonecks, who had come to New York in the great wave of Jewish immigration at the turn of the last century. And for each of the people she interviewed, she constructed a family tree, showing what a line of parents and children and grandchildren, and in some cases, great-grandchildren, did for a living. Here is her account of subject number 18. A Russian tailor artisan comes to America, takes to the needle trade, works in a sweatshop for a small salary. Later takes garments to finish at home with the help of his wife and older children. In order to increase his salary, he works through the night. Later, he makes a garment and sells it on New York streets. He accumulates some capital and goes into a business venture with his sons. They open a shop to create men's garments. Their garments are a better quality than what is available in the New World, and they soon discover a great demand for their garments. The Russian tailor and his sons become men's suit manufacturers, supplying several men's stores. The sons and the father become prosperous. The son's children become educated professionals. The Russian tailor's family tree looks something like this. The first generation was a tailor. He had three sons, all of whom were garment makers. He had two grandsons, both of whom were lawyers. Here's another of Farkas's family trees. It's a tanner who immigrates from Poland in the late 19th century. He has three sons, all of whom were bag manufacturers. He has seven grandsons. The first is a doctor, the second is a doctor, the third is a doctor, the fourth is a doctor, the fifth is a lawyer, the sixth is a lawyer, and the seventh is a lawyer. Farkas's Jewish family trees go on for pages, each virtually identical to the last, until the conclusion becomes inescapable. Jewish doctors and lawyers did not become professionals in spite of their origins. They became professionals because of their origins. Ted Friedman, the prominent litigator in the 1970s and 1980s, remembers as a child going to concerts with his mother at Carnegie Hall. They were poor and living in the furthest corners of the Bronx. How did they afford tickets? Mary got a quarter, Friedman says. There was a Mary who was a ticket taker, and if you gave Mary a quarter, she would let you stand in the second balcony without a ticket. Carnegie Hall didn't know about it. It was just between you and Mary. It was a bit of a journey, but we would go back once or twice a month. Friedman's mother was a Russian immigrant. She barely spoke English, but she had gone to work as a seamstress at the age of 15 and had become a prominent garment union organizer. And what you learn in that world is that through your own powers of persuasion and initiative, you can take your kids to Carnegie Hall. There is no better lesson for a budding lawyer than that. The garment industry was boot camp for the professions. What did Joe Flom's father do? He sewed shoulder pads for women's dresses. What did Robert Oppenheimer's father do? He was a garment manufacturer, like Louis Borgenicht. One flight up from Flom's corner office at Skadden is the office of Barry Garfinkel, who has been at Skadden nearly as long as Flom, and for many years headed the firm's litigation department. What did Garfinkel's mother do? She was a milliner. She made hats at home. What did two of Louis and Regina Borgenicht's sons do? They went to law school, and no less than nine of their grandchildren ended up as doctors and lawyers as well. The most remarkable of Farkas's family trees is about a Jewish family from Romania who had a small grocery store in the old country and then came to New York and opened another on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. It is the most elegant answer to the question of where all the Joe Flom's come from. The grandfather is a small grocer. He has five sons, all of whom go into the supermarket business. And his grandsons? Doctor, 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 psychologist, doctor, doctor, lawyer, 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 doctor. 10 blocks north of the Skadden Arps headquarters in Midtown Manhattan are the offices of Joe Flom's great rival, the law firm generally regarded as one of the finest in the world. It is headquartered in the prestigious office building known as BlackRock. To get hired there takes a small miracle. Unlike New York's other major law firms, all of which have hundreds of attorneys scattered around the major capitals of the world, it operates only out of that single Manhattan building. It turns down much more business than it accepts. It does not bill by the hour, like every one of its competitors. It simply names a fee. Once, while defending Kmart against a takeover, the firm billed $20 million for 2 weeks' work. Kmart paid, happily. If its attorneys do not outsmart you, they will outwork you. And if they can't outwork you, they will win through sheer intimidation. There is no firm in the world that has made more money, lawyer for lawyer, over the last two decades. On Joe Flom's wall, next to pictures of Flom with George Bush and Flom with Bill Clinton, there is a picture of him with the rival firm's managing partner. No one rises to the top of the New York legal profession unless he or she is smart and ambitious and hardworking, and clearly the four men who founded the BlackRock firm fit that description. But we know far more than that, don't we? Success is not a random act. It arises out of a predictable and powerful set of circumstances and opportunities, and at this point, after examining the lives of Bill Joy and Bill Gates, pro hockey players and geniuses, and Joe Flom, the Janklows, and the Borgenicks, it shouldn't be hard to figure out where the perfect lawyer comes from. They will have been born in a demographic trough, so they had the best of New York City's public schools and the easiest time in the job market. They will be Jewish, of course, so they had the great fortune to have been locked out of the old line downtown law firms on account of their antecedents. They will have had parents who did meaningful work in the garment business, so they could have learned autonomy and complexity and the connection between effort and reward. They will have gone to a good school, although it doesn't have to be a great school. They don't have to have been the smartest in their class, only smart enough. In fact, we can be even more precise. Just as there is a perfect birth date for a 19th century robber baron and a perfect birth date for a software tycoon, there is a perfect birth date for a New York Jewish lawyer as well. It's 1930, or thereabouts, because that would give the lawyer the benefit of a blessedly small generation. It would also make him 40 years of age in 1970, when the revolution in the legal world first began, which translates to a healthy 15-year Homburg period in the takeover business, while the white shoe lawyers lingered obliviously over their two martini lunches at the Princeton Club. If you want to be a great New York lawyer, it is an advantage to be an outsider, and it is an advantage to have parents who did meaningful work, and better still to have been born in the early 1930s. But if you have all three advantages, on top of a good dose of ingenuity and drive, then that's an unstoppable combination. That's like being a hockey player born on January 1st. The BlackRock firm is Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen, and Katz. The firm's first partner was Herbert Wachtell. He was born in 1931. He grew up in the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Union housing across from Van Cortlandt Park in the Bronx. His parents were Jewish immigrants from the Ukraine. His father was in the ladies' undergarment business with his brothers on the sixth floor of what is now a fancy loft at Broadway and Spring Street in Soho. He went to New York City public schools in the 1940s, then City College in Upper Manhattan, and then on to New York University Law School. The second partner was Martin Lipton. He was born in 1931. His father was a manager at a factory in Hoboken. His grandfather was a Jewish immigrant from Europe. He attended public schools in Jersey City, then the University of Pennsylvania, then New York University Law School. The third partner was Leonard Rosen. He was born in 1930. He grew up poor in the Bronx near Yankee Stadium. His parents were Jewish immigrants from the Ukraine. His father worked in the garment district in Manhattan as a presser. He went to New York City public schools in the 1940s, then City College in Upper Manhattan, then New York University Law School. The fourth partner was George Katz. He was born in 1931. He grew up in a one-bedroom, first-floor apartment in the Bronx. His parents were the children of Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe. His father sold insurance. His grandfather, who lived a few blocks away, was a sewer in the garment trades, doing piecework out of his house. He went to New York City public schools in the 1940s, then City College in Upper Manhattan, then New York University Law School. Imagine that we had met any one of these four, fresh out of law school, sitting in the elegant waiting room at Mudge Rose. Next to them, the blue-eyed Nordic type from the right background. We'd all have bet on the Nordic type to be the most successful. And we would have been wrong, because the Katzes and the Rosens and the Liptons and the Wachtells and the Floms had something that the Nordic type did not. Their world, their culture and generation and family history gave them the greatest of opportunities. Part 2. Legacy. Chapter 6. Harlan, Kentucky. Die like a man like your brother did. In the southeastern corner of Kentucky, in the stretch of the Appalachian Mountains known as the Cumberland Plateau, lies a small town called Harlan. The Cumberland Plateau is a wild and mountainous region of flat-topped ridges, mountain walls 500 to 1,000 feet high, and narrow valleys, some wide enough only for a one-lane road and a creek. When the area was first settled, the mountainsides and valleys were covered with a dense primeval forest. Giant tulip poplars grew in the coves and at the foot of the hills, some with trunks as wide as 7 or 8 feet in diameter. Alongside them were white oaks, beeches, maples, walnuts, sycamores, birches, willows, cedars, pines, and hemlocks, all enmeshed in a lattice of wild grapevine comprising one of the greatest assortment of forest trees in the northern hemisphere. On the ground were bears and mountain lions and rattlesnakes. In the treetops, an astonishing array of squirrels, and beneath the soil, one thick seam after another of coal. Harlan County was founded in 1819 by 8 immigrant families from the northern regions of the British Isles. They had come to Virginia in the 18th century and then moved west into the Appalachians in search of land. The county was never wealthy. For its first 100 years, it was thinly populated, rarely numbering more than 10,000 people. The first settlers kept pigs and herded sheep on the hillsides, scratching out a living on small farms in the valleys. They made whiskey in backyard stills and felled trees, floating them down the Cumberland River in the spring when the water was high. Until well into the 20th century, getting to the nearest train station was a 2-day wagon trip. The only way out of town was up Pine Mountain, which was 9 steep miles from bottom to top on a road that turned, on occasion, into no more than a muddy, rocky trail. Harlan was a remote and strange place, unknown by the larger society around it, and may well have remained so but for the fact that 2 of the town's founding families, the Howards and the Turners, did not get along. The patriarch of the Howard clan was Samuel Howard. He built the town courthouse and the jail. His counterpart was William Turner, who owned a tavern and 2 general stores. Once, a storm blew down the fence to the Turner property, and a neighbor's cow wandered onto their land. William Turner's grandson, Devil Jim, shot the cow dead. The neighbor was too terrified to press charges and fled the county. Another time, a man tried to open a competitor to the Turner's general store. The Turners had a word with him. He closed the store and moved to Indiana. One night, Wicks Howard and Little Bob Turner, the grandsons of Samuel and William respectively, played against each other in a game of poker. Each accused the other of cheating. They fought. The following day, they met in the street, and after a flurry of gunshots, Little Bob Turner lay dead with a shotgun blast to the chest. A group of Turners went to the Howard's general store and spoke roughly to Mrs. Howard. She was insulted and told her son, Wills Howard, who the following week exchanged gunfire with another of Turner's grandsons, young Will Turner, on the road to Hagen, Virginia. That night, one of the Turners and a friend attacked the Howard home. The 2 families then clashed outside the Harlan courthouse. In the gunfire, Will Turner was shot and killed. A contingent of Howards then went to see Mrs. Turner, the mother of Will Turner and Little Bob, to ask for a truce. She declined. "You can't wipe out that blood," she said, pointing to the dirt where her son had died. Things went from bad to worse. Wills Howard ran into Little George Turner near Sulphur Springs and shot him dead. The Howards ambushed 3 friends of the Turners, the Cawoods, killing all of them. A posse was sent out in search of the Howards. In the resulting gunfight, 6 more were killed or wounded. Wills Howard heard the Turners were after him, and he and a friend rode into Harlan and attacked the Turner home. Riding back, the Howards were ambushed. In the fighting, another person died. Wills Howard rode to Little George Turner's house and fired at him, but missed and killed another man. A posse surrounded the Howard home. There was another gunfight. More dead. The county was in an uproar. I think you get the picture. There were places in 19th century America where people lived in harmony. Harlan, Kentucky was not one of them. "Stop that," Will Turner's mother snapped at him when he staggered home, howling in pain after being shot in the courthouse gun battle with the Howards. "Die like a man, like your brother did." She belonged to a world so well acquainted with fatal gunshots that she had certain expectations about how they ought to be endured. Will shut his mouth, and he died. Suppose you were sent to Harlan in the late 19th century to investigate the causes of the Howard-Turner feud. You lined up every surviving participant and interviewed them as carefully as you could. You subpoenaed documents and took depositions and pored over court records until you had put together a detailed and precise accounting of each stage in the deadly quarrel. How much would you know? The answer is, not much. You'd learned that there were some people in Harlan who didn't much like each other, and you'd confirmed that Wills Howard, who was responsible for an awful lot of the violence, probably belonged behind bars. But what happened in Harlan wouldn't become clear until you looked at the violence from a much broader perspective. The first critical fact about Harlan is that at the same time that the Howards and the Turners were killing each other, there were almost identical clashes in other small towns up and down the Appalachians. In the famous Hatfield-McCoy feud on the West Virginia-Kentucky border not far from Harlan, several dozen people were killed in a cycle of violence that stretched over 20 years. In the French Eversoll feud in Perry County, Kentucky, 12 died, 6 of them killed by Bad Tom Smith, a man, John Ed Pierce writes in Days of Darkness, who was just dumb enough to be fearless, just bright enough to be dangerous, and a dead shot. The Martin Tolliver feud in Rowan County, Kentucky in the mid-1880s featured 3 gunfights, 3 ambushes, and 2 house attacks, and ended in a 2-hour gun battle involving 100 armed men. The Baker-Howard feud in Clay County began in 1806 with an elk-hunting party gone bad and didn't end until the 1930s, when a couple of Howards killed 3 Bakers in an ambush. And these were just the well-known feuds. The Kentucky legislator Harry Caudill once looked in a circuit court clerk's office in one Cumberland Plateau town and found 1,000 murder indictments stretching from the end of the Civil War in the 1860s to the beginning of the 20th century, and this for a region that never numbered more than 15,000 people, and where many violent acts never even made it to the indictment stage. Caudill writes of a murder trial in Breathitt County, or Bloody Breathitt, as it came to be known, that ended abruptly when the defendant's father, a man of about 50 with huge handlebar whiskers and 2 immense pistols, walked up to the judge and grabbed his gavel. The feudist rapped the bench and announced, "Court's over and everybody can go. We ain't a-gonna have any court here this term, folks." The red-faced judge hastily acquiesced in this extraordinary order and promptly left town. When court convened at the next term, the court and sheriff were bolstered by 60 militiamen, but by then the defendant was not available for trial. He had been slain from ambush. When one family fights with another, it's a feud. When lots of families fight with one another in identical little towns up and down the same mountain range, it's a pattern. What was the cause of the Appalachian pattern? Over the years, many potential causes had been examined and debated, and the consensus appears to be that the region was plagued by a particularly virulent strain of what sociologists call the culture of honor. Cultures of honor tend to take root in highlands and other marginally fertile areas like Sicily or the mountainous Basque regions of Spain. If you live on some rocky mountainside, the explanation goes, you can't farm. You probably raise goats or sheep, and the kind of culture that grows up around being a herdsman is very different from the culture that grows up around growing crops. The survival of a farmer depends on the cooperation of others in the community. But a herdsman is off by himself. Farmers also don't have to worry that their livelihood will be stolen in the night, because crops can't easily be stolen, unless, of course, a thief wants to go to the trouble of harvesting an entire field all on his own. But a herdsman does. He's under constant threat of ruin through the loss of his animals, so he has to be aggressive. He has to make it clear through his words and deeds that he's not weak. He has to be willing to fight in response to even the slightest challenge to his reputation, and that's what the culture of honor means. It's a world where a man's reputation is at the center of his livelihood and self-worth. The critical moment in the development of the young shepherd's reputation is his first quarrel, the ethnographer J.K. Campbell writes, of one herding culture in Greece. Quarrels are necessarily public. They may occur in the coffee shop, the village square, or most frequently on a grazing boundary, where a curse or a stone aimed at one of his straying sheep by another shepherd is an insult which inevitably requires a violent response. So why was Appalachia the way it was? Because of where the original inhabitants of the region came from. The so-called American backcountry states, stretching from the Pennsylvania border south and west through Virginia and West Virginia, Kentucky and Tennessee, North Carolina and South Carolina, and the northern end of Alabama and Georgia, were settled overwhelmingly by immigrants from one of the world's most ferocious cultures of honor. They were Scotch-Irish, that is, from the lowlands of Scotland, the northern counties of England, and Ulster in Northern Ireland. These regions were known as the Borderlands, and they were remote and lawless territories that had been fought over for hundreds of years. The people of the region were steeped in violence. They were herdsmen scraping out a living on rocky and infertile land. They were clannish, responding to the harshness and turmoil of their environment by forming tight family bonds and placing loyalty to blood above all else. And when they emigrated to North America, they moved into the American interior, to remote, lawless, rocky, and marginally fertile places like Harlan, that allowed them to reproduce in the New World the culture of honor that they had created in the Old World. To the first settlers, the American backcountry was a dangerous environment, just as the British borderlands had been, the historian David Hackett Fisher writes in Albion Seed. Much of the Southern Highlands were debatable lands, in the border sense of a contested territory without established government or the rule of law. The borderers were more at home than others in this anarchic environment, which was well suited to their family system, their warrior ethic, their farming and herding economy, their attitudes towards land and wealth, and their ideas of work and power. So well adapted was the border culture to this environment that other ethnic groups tended to copy it. The ethos of the North British borders came to dominate this dark and bloody ground, partly by force of numbers, but mainly because it was a means of survival in a raw and dangerous world. The triumph of the culture of honor helps to explain why the pattern of criminality in the American South has always been so distinctive. Murder rates are higher there than the rest of the country, but crimes of property and stranger crimes, like muggings, are lower. As the sociologist John Shelton Reed has written, the homicides in which the South seems to specialize are those in which someone is being killed by someone he, or often she, knows, for reasons both the killer and victim understand. Reed adds, the statistics show that the Southerner who can avoid arguments and adultery is as safe as any other American, and probably safer. In the backcountry, violence wasn't for economic gain. It was personal. You fought over your honor. Many years ago, the Southern newspaperman Hodding Carter told the story of how, as a young man, he had served on a jury. As Reed describes it, the case before the jury involved an irascible gentleman who lived next door to a filling station. For several months, he had been the butt of various jokes played by the attendants and the miscellaneous loafers who hung around the station despite his warnings and his notorious short temper. One morning, he emptied both barrels of his shotgun at his tormentors, killing one, maiming another permanently, and wounding a third. When the jury was polled by the incredulous judge, Carter was the only juror who recorded his vote as guilty. As one of the others put it, he wouldn't have been much of a man if he hadn't shot them fellows. Only in a culture of honor would it have occurred to the irascible gentleman that shooting someone was an appropriate response to a personal insult. And only in a culture of honor would it have occurred to a jury that murder, under those circumstances, was not a crime. I realize that we are often wary of making these kinds of broad generalizations about different cultural groups, and with good reason. This is the form that racial and ethnic stereotypes take. We want to believe that we are not prisoners of our ethnic histories. But the simple truth is that if you want to understand what happened in those small towns in Kentucky in the 19th century, you have to go back into the past. And not just one or two generations. You have to go back 200 or 300 or 400 years to a country on the other side of the ocean and look closely at what exactly the people in a very specific geographic area of that country did for a living. The culture of honor hypothesis says that it matters where you're from, not just in terms of where you grew up or where your parents grew up, but in terms of where your great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents grew up, and even your great-great-great-grandparents grew up. That is a strange and powerful fact. It's just the beginning, though, because upon closer examination, cultural legacies turn out to be even stranger and more powerful than that. In the early 1990s, two psychologists at the University of Michigan, Duff Cohen and Richard Nisbet, decided to conduct an experiment on the culture of honor. They knew that what happened in places like Harlan in the 19th century was, in all likelihood, a product of patterns laid down in the English borderlands centuries before. But their interest was in the present day. Was it possible to find remnants of the culture of honor in the modern era? So they decided to gather together a group of young men and insult them. We sat down and tried to figure out what is the insult that would go to the heart of an 18 to 20-year-old's brain, Cohen says. It didn't take too long to come up with asshole. The experiment went like this. The social science building at the University of Michigan has a long, narrow hallway in the basement lined with filing cabinets. The young men were called into a classroom, one by one, and asked to fill out a questionnaire. Then they were told to drop off the questionnaire at the end of the hallway and return to the classroom. A simple, seemingly innocent academic exercise. For half the young men, that was it. They were the control group. For the other half, there was a catch. As they walked down the hallway with their questionnaire, another man, a confederate of the experimenters, walked past them and pulled out a drawer in one of the filing cabinets. The already narrow hallway became even narrower. As the young man tried to squeeze by, the confederate looked up, annoyed. He slammed the filing cabinet drawer shut, jostled the young man with his shoulder, and in a low but audible voice, he said the trigger word, asshole. Cohen and Nisbet wanted to measure, as precisely as possible, what being called that word meant. They looked at the faces of their subjects and rated how much anger they saw. They shook the young men's hands to see if their grip was firmer than usual. They took saliva samples from the students, both before and after the insult, to see if being called an asshole caused their levels of testosterone and cortisol, the hormones that drive arousal and aggression, to go up. Finally, they asked the students to read the following story and supply a conclusion. It had only been about 20 minutes since they arrived at the party when Jill pulled Steve aside, obviously bothered about something. "What's wrong?" asked Steve. "It's Larry. I mean, he knows that you and I are engaged, but he's already made two passes at me tonight." Jill walked back into the crowd, and Steve decided to keep his eye on Larry. Sure enough, within 5 minutes, Larry was reaching over and trying to kiss Jill. If you've been insulted, are you more likely to imagine Steve doing something violent to Larry? The results were unequivocal. There were clear differences in how the young men responded to being called a bad name. For some, it didn't. But the deciding factor wasn't how emotionally secure they were, or whether they were an intellectual or a jock, or whether they were physically imposing or not. What mattered, and I think you can guess where this is headed, is where they were from. The young men from the northern part of the United States, for the most part, treated the incident with amusement. They laughed it off. Their handshakes were unchanged. Their levels of cortisol actually went down, as if they were unconsciously trying to diffuse their own anger. Only a few of them had Steve get violent with Larry. But the Southerners? Oh my. They were angry. Their cortisol and testosterone jumped. Their handshakes got firm. Steve was all over Larry. "We even played this game of chicken," Cohen said. "We sent the students back down the hallway, and around the corner comes another Confederate. The hallway is blocked, so there's only room for one of them to pass. The guy we used was 6'3", 250 pounds. He used to play college football. He was now working as a bouncer in a college bar. He was walking down the hall in business mode, the way you walk through a bar when you're trying to break up a fight. The question was, how close do they get to the bouncer before they get out of the way? And believe me, they always get out of the way." For the Northerners, there was almost no effect. They got out of the way 5 or 6 feet beforehand, whether they had been insulted or not. The Southerners, by contrast, were downright deferential in normal circumstances, stepping aside with more than 9 feet to go. But if they had just been insulted, less than 2 feet. Call a Southerner an asshole, and he's itching for a fight. What Cohen and Nisbet were seeing in that long hall was the culture of honor in action. The Southerners were reacting like Wicks Howard did when Little Bob Turner accused him of cheating at poker. That study is strange, isn't it? It's one thing to conclude that groups of people living in circumstances pretty similar to their ancestors act a lot like their ancestors. But those Southerners in the hallway study weren't living in circumstances similar to their British ancestors. They didn't even necessarily have British ancestors. They just happened to have grown up in the South. None of them were herdsmen. Nor were their parents herdsmen. They were living in the late 20th century, not the late 19th century. They were students at the University of Michigan in one of the northernmost states in America, which meant that they were sufficiently cosmopolitan to travel hundreds of miles from the South to go to college. And none of that mattered. They still acted like they were living in 19th century Harlan, Kentucky. Your median student in these studies comes from a family making over $100,000, and that's in 1990 dollars, Cohen says. The Southerners we see this effect with aren't kids who come from the hills of Appalachia. They're more likely to be the sons of upper-middle management Coca-Cola executives in Atlanta. And that's the big question. Why should we get this effect with them? Why should one get it hundreds of years later? Why are these suburban Atlanta kids acting out the ethos of the frontier? Cultural legacies are powerful forces. They have deep roots and long lives. They persist generation after generation, virtually intact, even as the economic and social and demographic conditions that spawned them have vanished. And they play such a role in directing attitudes and behavior that we cannot make sense of our world without them. So far in Outliers, we've seen that success arises out of the steady accumulation of advantages. When and where you were born, and what your parents did for a living, and what the circumstances of your upbringing were like, all make a significant difference in how well you do in the world. The question for the second part of Outliers is whether the traditions and attitudes we inherit from our forebears can play the same role. Can we learn something about how people succeed and how to make people better at what they do by taking cultural legacies seriously? I think we can. Chapter 7. The Ethnic Theory of Plane Crashes. Captain, the weather radar has helped us a lot. On the morning of August 5th, 1997, the captain of Korean Air Flight 801 woke at 6 a.m. His family would later tell investigators that he went to the gym for an hour, then came home and studied the flight plan for that evening's journey to Guam. He napped and ate lunch. At 3 p.m, he left for Seoul, departing early enough, his wife said, to continue his preparations at Gimpo International Airport. He had been a pilot with Korean Air for almost 4 years, after coming over from the Korean Air Force. He had 8,900 hours of flight time, including 3,200 hours of experience in jumbo jets. A few months earlier, he had been given a flight safety award by his airline for successfully handling a jumbo jet engine failure at low altitude. He was 42 years old and in excellent health. At 7 p.m., the captain, his first officer, and the flight engineer met and collected the trip's paperwork. They would be flying a Boeing 747, a model known in the aviation world as the Classic. The aircraft was in perfect working order. It had once been the Korean presidential plane. Flight 801 departed the gate at 10:30 in the evening and was airborne 20 minutes later. Takeoff was without incident. Just before 1:30 in the morning, the plane broke out of the clouds and the flight crew glimpsed lights off in the distance. "Is it Guam?" the flight engineer asked. Then, after a pause, he said, "It's Guam. Guam." The captain chuckled. "Good." The first officer reported to air traffic control that the airplane was clear of Charlie Bravo, cumulonimbus clouds, and requested radar vectors for runway 6 left. The plane began its descent towards Guam Airport. They would make a visual approach, the captain said. He had flown into Guam Airport from Gimpo 8 times previously, most recently a month ago, and he knew the airport and the surrounding terrain well. The landing gear went down. The flaps were extended 10 degrees. At 1:41 and 48 seconds, the captain said, "Wiper on," and the flight engineer turned them on. It was raining. The first officer then said, "Not in sight?" He was looking for the runway. He couldn't see it. 1 second later, the ground proximity warning system called out in its electronic voice, 500 feet. The plane was 500 feet off the ground, but how could that be if they couldn't see the runway? 2 seconds passed. The flight engineer said, "Eh?" in an astonished tone of voice. At 1:42:19, the first officer said, "Let's make a missed approach," meaning, "Let's pull up and make a large circle and try the landing again." 1 second later, the flight engineer said, "Not in sight." The first officer added, "Not in sight. Missed approach." At 1:42:22, the flight engineer said, again, "Go around." At 1:42:23, the captain repeated, "Go around." But he was slow to pull the plane out of its descent. At 1:42:26, the plane hit the side of Nimitz Hill, a densely vegetated mountain 3 miles southwest of the airport. $60 million and 212,000 kilograms of steel slamming into rocky ground at 100 miles an hour. The plane skidded for 2,000 feet, severing an oil pipeline and snapping pine trees, before falling into a ravine and bursting into flames. By the time rescue workers reached the crash site, 228 of the 254 people on board were dead. 20 years before the crash of KL-801, a Korean Air Boeing 707 wandered into Russian airspace and was shot down by a military jet over the Barents Sea. It was an accident, meaning the kind of rare and catastrophic event that, for the grace of God, could happen to any airline. It was investigated and analyzed. Lessons were learned. Reports were filed. Then, 2 years later, a Korean Air Boeing 747 crashed in Seoul. 2 accidents in 2 years is not a good sign. 3 years after that, the airline lost another 747 near Sakhalin Island in Russia, followed by a Boeing 707 that went down over the Andaman Sea in 1987, 2 more crashes in 1989 in Tripoli and Seoul, and then another in 1994 in Jeju, South Korea. To put that record in perspective, the loss rate for an airline like the American carrier United Airlines in the period 1988 to 1998 was 0.27 per million departures, which means that they lost a plane in an accident about once in every 4 million flights. The loss rate for Korean Air in the same period was 4.79 per million departures, 17 times higher. Korean Air's planes were crashing so often that when the National Transportation Safety Board, NTSB, the U.S. agency responsible for investigating plane crashes within American jurisdiction, did its report on the Guam crash, it was forced to include an addendum listing all the new Korean Air accidents that had happened just since its investigation began. The Korean Air 747 that crash-landed at Gimpo in Seoul almost a year to the day after Guam, the jetliner that overran a runway at Korea's Ulsan Airport 8 weeks after that, the Korean Air McDonnell Douglas that rammed into an embankment at Pohang Airport the following March, and then, a month after that, the Korean Air passenger jet that crashed in a residential area of Shanghai. Had the NTSB waited just a few more months, it could have added another. The Korean Air cargo plane that crashed just after takeoff from London's Stansted Airport, despite the fact that a warning bell went off in the cockpit no fewer than 14 times.